double aces could come up for you, and all of a sudden you were down, you're down by six, now you're up by one.
Spike scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait. Designation: Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to another vacation episode of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Red Powell.
Oh snap, vacation edition, I'm back.
Welcome back. You missed the first vacation episode because, you know, you were working.
Dang. I was on my own vacation. Military vacation in the desert, having a good time.
Tanya Gates.
Hey everybody.
And Adam Camilleri.
Evening, everybody.
Oh, it is so awesome to be here. And I will say we are actually brought to you by our patrons on Patreon that have thankfully, you know, decided to join in. And, you know, because of that, we get to have some of these episodes going to be edited by actual editors. And
what? That means you're going to have vacations?
You're
going to be able to, like, have weekends? You're going to be able to, like, leave the house?
I think we're talking about, like, getting the grass cut and some other things here. You know? The things that, you know, whatever. It's still going to be, it's a trade-off. But, you know, again, super grateful. Tristan Godbold, Patrick Gill, Skugga, Thomas Caldwell, Carla and Chris, and Kelsey Ito. We could not be doing this episode without y'all. Thank y'all very much, new patrons, for this episode. If it's something that you decide you might want to do, the link will be in the show notes. Check us out. It means a whole lot. You know, again, this is the vacation episodes in between what was season one and what will become season two. And looking forward to bringing y'all many more episodes. I'm excited.
A dangerous precedent just set there. Paul, you know, setting the precedent that he will read out your names should you become a patron. I want to see some Sanguinius did nothing wrong. I want to see some Magnus did everything right signing up to our patron in the near future. I want to see ha ha ha, Sanguinor's not real. You know, that kind of stuff.
Oh no, I don't like that you've unleashed that evil out there. But
hey, if it leads to an explosion, an exponential increase in patronage, like, you know, the give and take, baby.
It was, you know, on new ground as far as like starting a Patreon, and, you know, because I know people do like the show and want to be a part of it, and again, it means a lot. And if it's like a t-shirt, it's not your thing, but Patreon is, then, you know, it's one way to support the episodes and the cast. And again, from the bottom of my heart, thank y'all for doing that and joining in. But we're getting towards closer and closer with every day inching towards a brand new edition of Warhammer 40,000.
Got to say, I'm pretty excited. I don't know how everyone out there is feeling about 9th edition, but I am ready. Nothing overtly negative to say about the edition, just that it's time. I'm ready for a transition. And the more I hear about the new one, the more I'm kind of I'm thrilled. It looks like we know 8th edition was very much a brand new beginning for how the game was structured and the game was going to be played, and 9th edition was an evolution of that. And this one looks like it's not an evolution of 9th so much as it is taking the best bits of kind of the last four editions, everything from 6th up until now, and putting in the bits that worked the best then or at the time. And so I think it's an extremely exciting concept that is unfolding as we speak.
I'm hanging on the edge of basically every Warhammer community article, and there's some things that have jumped out at me, you know, that have got me kind of interested in using some of those figures that maybe I haven't done in a while, like a Land Raider.
See, there's parts of my soul that is like, let me just say goodbye to the Vindicator. Let it have an end point so we can push it off down to Valhalla, you know, on its bed of roses or whatever. But I mean, I was not ready to let go of the Land Raider, and I'm still not. And so I'm so grateful that they might be, you know, saying, hey, this one's here to stay, and we will maintain this icon of the game.
What do y'all think about, like, the toughness characteristic on some of these vehicles that we've seen being, and let's compare it to the Meltagun, you know, that we've seen. Vehicles are tough as 12, 13.
I think it's good. I think expanding the metric, right? I think that it had been, there were degrees of simplification, and simplifying things can be good. But at the same time, it removes other levels of variation. And I don't mind the variation. I mean, we have 16 plus factions. You can't really mind the variation, or else everything becomes the same. Some of those factions, like Space Marines, Chaos Space Marines, so on and so forth, have split into multiple other things. And all that to say, like, the ability to give something a toughness of 12, you know, it doesn't get automatically tapped out by a Meltagun. But a Meltagun does have that significant advantage in it. It really broadens, it actually, you know, increases or widens the threshold, because now you're looking for to go to a 2-up, right, on a Melta, you're looking for toughness to be able to get away from that. You need a much higher toughness.
Well, looking at the Space Marine article that came out earlier in May, the Land Raider being toughness 12, and it gives us some weapon ranges, some stats here. The Multi-Melta, 18-inch at 2 attacks, 2 shots, 3-plus Blizzard skill. And what we can talk about the Blizzard skill on like each of the weapon profiles. That's kind of interesting. It might lead you to believe there might be some variants or whatever. But strength 9, you know, so Meltagun's no longer the go-to for something like Land Raider.
Exactly. And I think that's good. I think it allows things. I think we saw a case where you saw, you know, the shifts in the meta of 40K where eradicators were such a thing that we quit bringing vehicles out to such an extent. And then as the eradicators phased away, you could bring back in the vehicles, so on and so forth. It went back and forth. And now it's a little more, you kind of have to accept that there's things that are just tough out there. It's not to the same degree as Horus Heresy, the old school armor values where you just couldn't hurt things at all. Like, you know, your bolter just can't injure it at all. But at least by, again, increasing the range of toughness versus strength, I do think it makes that wound roll that much more critical when you can get something in. And to be fair, the damage value is increasing on a lot of these weapons. Meltagun included. So it's, and the number of wounds increasing for some of these things, it makes it pretty, I do think that there's a lot more engagement in certain cases, but it does allow things to be tough. Whereas I think things were struggling. You know, we used to, you could probably go back and find every other episode where we talked about just how killy everything is, how much overwhelming firepower things brought out. And I don't necessarily mind that to a certain extent, because that's been an existing geometric thing of warfare for a long time. Like there's, you know, everybody wore armor to defend themselves from weapons. And then to a point, firearms grew beyond that to a certain extent. And then you needed vehicles with armor, and then it would just went back and forth. But it's okay for things in 40K to not just crumple like paper under all of the firepower that's out there. There needs to be things that can endure.
Well, I love it mostly because of the, I think even G-Dub started doing this towards the end of the edition. We started seeing more granularity in the toughness value, especially more toughness 9 things like the Land Raider, you know, going to toughness 9, a lot more tough
Space Marine book.
Yeah, sorry, Chaos Space Marine 1's a lot more toughness 6 to 9 rather than just having 6s, 7s. You know, this is the thing, and everything like a Viper, everything like a Land Speeder in the game is the same toughness. Does not matter who's has it or who's running it. You know, if it's a 10,000 year old Land Raider, it's one more toughness. You know, I kind of feel like that's fair over a regular one. And so I think it was really important to expand the granularity of especially the toughness value. A gun that is built by the Imperium to pop and kill like a Xenos vehicle or a Tyranid Gribbly shouldn't be just as good at wounding a Tyrannifex as it is at wounding their own Land Raider, the one they just got out of. You know, there should be some give and take within this, and some I think you said it well, some not so many parallels. Like, there isn't just a one gun that's good into everything in the galaxy, which is what we found in plasma guns in 8th edition. Which gun did you want? A plasma gun. Why? It hurt everything. It hurt everything really well. And this one, I think the melter and the multi-melter equivalents in 9th edition, you could say the same. Which gun should I take? The one with that profile. The one that does more damage the closer you get, but is Ren 4, Strength 8 all the time. It is the profile that is ubiquitously good. And I don't think there should be any of those.
Yeah, in previous editions, they were sometimes defined by the Power Fist in the last cannon, or the Melta gun and the plasma gun kind of thing. They have been defined by those.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to see. I've said this on many before, but it was Thunder Hammers and Plasma Guns. 8th edition was the two best profiles you could have if you had an army that had an equivalent of those and you could spam it. Those were the right choices ubiquitously. And I don't like that. 9th edition, you could say the same of Melta Guns and Lightning Claws for the majority. Just having massed attacks with rerolls and good rend was everything you ever needed. And because you had the Melta Gun that was doing the damage before you went in, a lot of the time the Lightning Claw was just a finisher. Or you were playing against pick your horde of choice or your horde of wounds of choice, you know, be it toughness 4, 3 wounds of pop Tyranid warriors that are in units of 9, so it's 27 wounds, or your 20 brick of Necron warriors, intercessors, etc., etc. I want to see less of that. I want to see everyone have good options and weapons, but no option being the only one I want all the time.
Do you think that's playing out with what the profiles we've kind of witnessed before? I mean, like, let's go to the Astra Militarum side of things. You know, we saw Baneblade profiles and autocannons seeming to get like a little bit of a glow up.
Would be cool. Would be cool to see autocannon be a good choice again, because, well, the fact is it had rend 1, and in the game where we stacked so much terrain on the tables, rend 1 might as well be rend 0, because, you know, everyone you're shooting is in cover, so therefore that rend profile is just kind of gone. That's another thing I really hope to see, actually. This is a bit of a tangent. I hope that we can start taking some terrain off the tables, because the game won't be as killy. We've put literally a third more terrain on the tables to cope with the fact that everything kills everything, and I hope we can go the other way.
You're on dangerous ground. I don't know if you see what you just did there.
Well, I hope we can take some off, because I don't like the game being so crowded and defined by, oh, can you go through a wall? Yes or no. If you are a seeker for demons is a phenomenal unit. You look at its profile, you look at how far it moves, the buffs you can put on it, the everything you can do with it, and then the price point it has on top of a demonette, because essentially it's a demonette that goes more faster when you boil it down. But then you look at, like, a regular demonette is way slower comparatively. It's cheaper, but it goes through walls, and so it's just better because it can go through walls. If we take away some of the walls, a lot more units get a new lease on life, because they don't have to weave in and out and around all these things.
As somebody who likes a thematic board, I can see the value of having less line of sight blocking terrain. I did like the terrain rules that they previewed a few weeks ago. I think that it'll be easier to make use of other types of terrain, so it'll look a little bit more thematic on the table while still kind of being competitive. For me, I don't really have a horse in this race, I don't think.
But I totally agree with you. Like, I played at the top competitive teams event in Australia this past weekend, and every table looked the same. They all had the same 4 pieces of terrain. It was either forest, essentially a pseudo crater, or a vent, as we've had to invent. And then it just had your selection of a ruin with a window or a ruin without windows. And then it was just that ad nauseum on every table. And that's what has had to happen in order to create tables that have a certain linear play pattern, a certain way of a predictability of stability, I like to call it. It's going to be stable. No one player is going to get absolutely annihilated because their side has to run, the other doesn't. Well, I would like to see tables that aren't mirrored as well. I would like us to be able to go back to there being an advantage on table pick, because right now which side of the table you play on does not matter at all on a lot of tournament tables, because it's the same thing.
Talking about a specific style of play.
I'm referring to the way I play the game most often, which is at a competitive level, which isn't for everybody, but I would like to see the competitive level get back to more narrative elements as well.
I see what you mean. Not necessarily require that to be every board to be a cookie cutter, and potentially, you know, we're talking about hopes and dreams, you know.
Exactly right.
I mean, are we talking hopes and dreams?
Well, no.
I mean,
I'm saying that was framed in a hopes and dreams box, which you got.
Yeah, I mean, Adam wants his cake and he wants to eat it too. I get it.
Yeah, like, I want it all. And why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I try and have it all, you know? I mean, sure. Maybe it's not possible, but I want to reach for it.
This is the time where we can actually, you know, feel that way. This is where everything is possible. We don't know what's coming.
Sure. I mean, I just think I want more dynamic, thematic, and advantageous terrain, but I want less of it. I think makes it difficult to. I think that makes that's a really tough request, because if they do that, they're going to want to put more of it on the table, right? Like the, and it's not just about them as in the game creators, but I also think in the aspect of it, I completely agree, and I'm sticking to my guns that I've been on since we've started this, that I love thematic tables. I love dynamic and asymmetric tables, to the extent that, yes, I'm sorry, if you choose the wrong side, you did choose a disadvantage. It absolutely exists. This little adventure in the desert that I was just at for 7 weeks, 49 days spent out there, there is a distinct...
Counting?
Right, yeah, who's counting? There's a distinct advantage going one direction versus the other, and This was my seventh adventure out there in that same desert over my 18 years in the Army. And that this is the first time that I've had the opportunity to go one direction versus the other, right? And so in this tactical exercise, there was a matter of choosing your table side. It was dictated to us, but I got to see what it was like to pick the other side of the table. And I'll tell you what, it was essentially the entire thing was downhill going west to east. And I could see with all of our equipment and whatnot, you could see much, much further. And I see why it's been so difficult fighting the other six times that I did it, because it was not only fighting uphill, but the other player, the other team could see everything I was doing the entire time. They knew exactly where we were coming from. They could see us go into any defensive terrain. They saw it all play out, and there was an absolute advantage to it. And I think that we go into, I understand, I do. I get the competitive thing of, like, you know, minimizing variables and reducing it, despite the fact that we play a dice game and that we just talked about how the variables have been expanded because of toughness values and whatnot, despite the fact that we have 16 factions that are constantly changing and constantly updating. And all the other factors that go into it, we think that the best way to maintain and standardize variables is to go in and make a table that is exactly the same across from one another, because one, it's, you know, there's that's one less thing that someone's going to complain about, that, oh, well, he got the advantageous terrain because he made one dice roll or what have you. Yeah, there could be other factors that play into that, but they haven't gone in that direction. But I do think that smart terrain usage is more than just a small fraction of the battle. It's just like we talk about going into it with the right list composition and everything like that. If you know how to use the terrain and fight the terrain and you know how to take advantage of it, I mean, I can't ding you for it. And even more so if the terrain is characterized in such a way. We have an actual military term for what we call something identified as key terrain, which means that it provides a marked advantage for either whoever controls it gains a marked advantage. And there isn't really a factor element like that in these. There can be to a certain degree. You could have a symmetric table where there is a key terrain piece that whoever owns that gains a marked advantage, but it doesn't share the same dynamic element if the table is more asymmetric. And I think that it really makes for the character of the game and the spirit of it. And I know there's a whole other aspect into seizing the initiative and things like that that I know we don't do, but I do want to say in some of the reveals,
don't bring that back into the conversation.
Here you go. Yeah, let's put it back in the box. But the mission construction and the cards that they've offered up, I'm excited to see how that plays out. I'm excited to see how the gambits and the different aspects. I've played with the Open War deck. I've played with the Tempest of War decks. I do like those. And I do think that it offers some good variables, especially with like turn-by-turn objectives, which I know are a thing also in Age of Sigmar. I think that there's a lot of great intent right now as we head into 10th edition. I think, Paul, you're right. Like, we don't know. There is a lot to be explored. But I do think that I'm reluctant to say I want less of something right now until I know what I do like and what is out there. And so I say bring it on right now. And then we'll see how the chips fall as we get into it.
I do want to talk about the gambits here in a second, at least what we know about the gambits so far. But I want to bring up what I said about the autocannons is that, I guess specifically on the Baneblade here, they have focused on the Warhammer community site is the coaxial autocannon. So, you know, I guess we don't know if that's a, you know, the what all autocannons will be, but, you know, the coaxial autocannon is, you know, two attacks, ballistic skill 4+, strength 9, AP neg 1, damage 3.
Yeah, that's a marked increase on, what was the rend, sorry? What was the AP?
One, it's only one.
Yes, same AP, but just one more damage, what, two more strength? I suppose at some level, is this showing the, once again, I said the differentiation of profiles, because everything that there was only previously, there was pretty much anti-tank guns came in strength 6 with a lot of shots, and then less shots, more rend, more damage as you went up towards strength 8, and then sometimes strength 9 for your las cannon equivalents. Now, like I said, they've got the option to differentiate all those. Like the autocannon can be 2 shots, strength 9, AP 1, 3 damage, and then you could have, what would it be, maybe a star cannon, for Eldar, which for some reason was always the same strength as the Shuriken cannon. You know, you can chuck that up to strength 8, AP 1, 3 damage, and that can be a little differentiation point between those two guns. One more shot for the star cannon, one less shot, but one more strength for the auto cannon. And then we can have so much more variance in the profiles of what people are shooting.
The toughness on, like, troops that we've seen don't seem to be really varying too much from what we know today. So any change on the gun weapon profile, I think, has a meaningful impact.
Well, see, they already did a lot of the toughness values on infantry have been differentiated throughout this edition. Tyranid Griblies, Orcs going up by a pip, Space Marines staying pretty much exactly the same. Is it Nurglings and Brimstones and things like that going to toughness too? Or was that 8th edition?
Jeez, I think that was an 8th.
I'm at that long in the tooth. They're blending now. It's happening, guys. But you know, some differentiation has already started to occur. So maybe they're already future proofing halfway through this one. So we could see that maybe hold steady or even go to some greater extent. I mean, there were things like Tyrant Guard, Hive Guard went to toughness 6, I believe. Things like War Bosses went to toughness 6 as well. So there's a lot of already differentiation happening on infantry models that I've found really interesting.
Yeah, fair enough. What do y'all think about the ballistic skill being associated to the weapon profile?
I think it's
good. As an Age of Sigmar player, I love it. It is, I mean, as I guess I don't consider myself a veteran player, but I'm not like a new player either. But I play against a lot of new players, and seeing how easy it is for them to pick up Age of Sigmar, because like everything is just like in the steps on the weapon profile. I think it's going to be really great for getting new people into the game. I think it's going to demystify a lot of the rules, and getting more people into the game is always a good thing for me.
That's a good point. And it's also, not just ballistic skill, it's also weapon skill.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of exactly to Tanya's point, that it's just up front. You're not worried about like minus ones to hit. There are things like that as other effects, but instead of having a special rule for a weapon or something like that, it's just straight up Power Fist hit on 4s, Space Marines, you know, their chain swords hit on 3s, and just roll out with it instead of having to go back and forth with it. I think it's good.
I guess you could have different, like, you know, like you said, you had the Power Fist and whatever, and Thunder Hammers being their own thing. You could have a ways to differentiate the types of weapons that people have.
Exactly. The mount, you know, the mount of a Juggernaut hits on 4, the Juggernaut hits on 2s with these weapons, that kind of deal. It's easily differentiated for a model that might have multiple things attacking from it or something like that.
And I mean, like, a perfect example I had on the weekend is I'd have a forest and I'd have a guard. I played guard for this event, and I'd have a turret weapon shooting through a forest, and my opponent, you know, lightning fasted. Spent CP for lightning fast. So they've got minus one to hit. I've got minus one for the forest, but then I've got plus one on my turret and minus two on my hull weapons, which can only be minus by one. But for a new player, why does it have to be that hard? Why does it have to be that hard? Just look at the gun, and then like, forest, and you're minus one. So minus one, minus one. Oh, yeah, cool. Just minus one. Because, you know, don't know for sure yet, but if they've brought forward the can't stack negs and positives, you can't be plus two, can't be neg two to hit. That's easy. You just look there. Okay, you are neg one. Well, there's just minus to this 1-3 up that it says on the profile. Easy done.
I mean, I will say that I'm talking about this stuff is like, what do y'all think? But I'm actually loving it. I'm thinking it's going to be pretty cool, especially when we start getting into the character of certain units.
Mm. For sure.
So I have a barometer question for you. Do that, wait, Tanya?
Yeah.
No, they can't. They can't have. They don't have any challenge-s mechanics in AOS, do they? You can't challenge a character because characters don't join units over there.
No, not that I've come across. No, but there are some factions I haven't had the pleasure of playing against yet, but I haven't come across anything like that.
What do we think about them bringing back a challenge-esque mechanic?
You mean, like, is it possible?
I mean, would we want them to?
We need to see what the impact of characters are going to be.
I'm sorry. I've got a big grin. I'm big stupid grin on my face because I don't think there's a right answer to this. It's pure speculation. It's more just to kind of tease out who loathed and who loved the mechanic in the past.
Okay, so I feel like that kind of runs into the category of like some factions just don't have an answer for that, right? Like, yep. Thematically, it's great when you've got, like, an Emperor's Champion on one end, and you've got, like, I don't know, some sort of, like, Space Wolf character on the other end. And, of course, thematically, you want those two to call each other out and basically, like, duke it out on the battlefield. Hmm. But I could see that being very tactically frustrating for, like, Tau, you yeah. know? Like, oh, I'm going to challenge your Ethereal, and you're like, great, speaking. I'll just remove it. You know,
yeah.
you know, so that kind of, I think, would feel a little feel badsies. Mm. So I would tentatively say, like, thematically, I like it. I just don't know how it would end up being a balanced mechanic.
And the truth is, it kind of wasn't.
No,
it definitely was not. No.
It kinda,
and we're not saying
wasn't.
It's a part of this where we're completely on dreamland right now.
I'm just, no. I just put out a question. Would you want it back?
Yeah.
I would say... You can put it in. You can put it in, but I don't think that there should be negatives to the other person for saying no. Maybe they both get bonuses if they say yes, but I don't think anybody should get a negative.
That's interesting.
It's definitely a thing. So Horus Heresy has a similar mechanic like this, where a character can essentially attach into a unit and not be withdrawn from it, right? Mm-hmm. So like Night Lords, which I play, the Sevatar, one of my favorite characters from the books, he can essentially be joined by like his gang of Night Lord Terminators, and he becomes one, like it's a whole unit of them. You can't like remove him later. But there is still a challenge aspect to Horus Heresy because it's, you know, a variation of 7th edition. And so I don't mind it. I'm not opposed to that coming back in. I don't think that it's something that would necessarily burden the game, but I agree with Tanya that there's got to be consideration for some of the other, again, with 16 factions, you have to be cognizant of the different aspects of it, and those that I think some factions should suffer for it, for the inability to survive that kind of challenge aspect. But they also would likely have some kind of mechanism that would allow it to be frustrating as well to try and engage in that kind of method, right? Some kind of inherent defense mechanism that they've got going for them, possibly. Or it could be very much a weakness of that faction that they don't do well in challenges, and that's just something they have to work through. I mean, again, heaven forbid that we have something beyond paper, rock, scissors difficulties.
I mean, from a baseline, you know, conceptual perspective, in Horus Heresy, it makes all the sense in the world. That whole battle was fought over egos and
correct. And
all that, and everyone wanted to challenge and be the big dog on the battlefield whatsoever. And of course, and inherently, it's a Space Marine versus Space Marine combat, and a Space Marine versus Space Marine combat, it can have some level of balance. You know, that sergeant is gonna challenge you, and you know your lad has to accept. You know, they ain't saying no, baby. And so you can write your list appropriately. There ain't no war gear I can slap on a company commander in this side of Terra that is gonna hold up versus the Emperor's Champion, a Baden, you know, these things. So there shouldn't be any downside for
refractor field, man. Come on.
Well, dude, we're all fives all day.
when the Medusa's chain guy with his thunder hammer on a bike goes into your company commander and you stonewall 5+ those 5 attacks, you felt like such a baller. But it's very unlikely. But at the same time, when that Medusa's chain thunder hammer crazy lad knocks the head off your company commander, your boys should just be like, you were going to do that anyway. Hell, I could do that. That's nothing. There's no benefits to you for killing that guy who was literally like kicking a puppy, you know, concept, like, you know, super soldier versus, you know, regular dude from around the corner. Average fit man fights super soldier. no morale boosts for you, son, for winning that combat.
It's like, a week ago I was selling insurance. Now I have to fight a super soldier.
Yeah, this is right. The rest of the guys are like, yeah, we're not impressed.
We are super off in speculation territory. Let's take a quick break, then we'll come back and continue this kind of like reflecting on what we know about 10 so far.
Regular fit man.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. Got everybody here. Gambits, one of the most, you know, when they were hinted that they were going to exist, The comment section kind of lit up, you know, on the social medias and stuff like that, with people not knowing what to expect. I don't know that we still know what to expect, but we have a little bit more information about them. Have you all had a chance to check them out?
Just from the community page, I didn't get to go much deeper. I don't know if they've talked about it anywhere else, but I think it's something worth being excited about.
What it says here is there are two Gambit decks with identical cards. They contain challenging goals that players can attempt to achieve by the end of the battle instead of attempting to score any more victory points from the primary mission. At the end of the third battle round, starting the next battle round, players can generate gambits and choose whether to attempt to achieve one. Each player takes their gambit deck and removes the proceed as planned card, placing it to the side before shuffling in the remaining gambit cards and randomly discarding one. Each player then adds the proceed as planned card back into it to have a hand containing three cards. Players then secretly choose one of these three cards and place it face down to the battlefield. Once both players have done so, they reveal their choice. If a player reveals their proceed as planned card, they are not attempting a gambit, and this battle continues to score victory points by achieving the goals on the primary mission card. Otherwise, the player is attempting a gambit, and until the end of the battle, that player cannot score any more VPs as described on the primary mission card. Basically, let me sum up. You give up your primary mission that you were trying to achieve before and instead go to try to risk it for the biscuit, as it were, and get a collection of points for what might be a more challenging and risky thing, but it's something you might use if the game is close, but you don't see a path to victory. It's not mathematically possible for you to achieve that victory if you were to proceed as planned.
And the Tempest of War decks, for those who've been playing since last edition, is pretty close to the Maelstrom deck that we used to play with, right? I played, I think, about three or four games with the Tempest of War deck. I genuinely enjoy it. I think the fact that kind of light criticisms of the competitive packets for 9th edition have been that the game feels a little formulaic, like you, at a very high level, especially Paul, as well, can probably echo this. When you see two absolute gun players going at it, as soon as you look at their secondaries and then the lists that they've taken, you can get pretty close to figuring out within about 10 points where they're going to end up on the scoreboard.
And give a projection about where you expect them to end up, by what is achievable, what they have on the table. You know, you can start to kind of math it out.
Mm. And while I do like that for some elements of the top levels of competitive play, I like a bit more chaos. And I feel like battle should have a bit more chaos to it. And I think this is what is going to ensue with the Tempest of War decks. But one of the biggest issues I had with Maelstrom was that if someone just pulls the absolute nuts cards, like their first hand of cards is just the absolute bee's knees.
And while you're pulling garbage, it was like a...
Exactly right. To turn one, they score five, you score 1 point. You're like, dang. Is there any coming back from this? And I like the fact that they've built a little backdoor clause where you can just be like, hey, Hail Mary, baby, let's go. Put it all on red. Push it in the middle. Let's see what happens.
I like that you said Hail Mary there because, you know, Hail Mary in a football game, because it's a reference to American football, to where I'm not like a big sports guy. So please pardon my example if I get a nuance wrong.
That is good. Keep going.
But one of the teams is down by 6 or 7 points, maybe even 8 points, you know, and they've got precious few seconds left in the game. They have to do a risky maneuver that's only going to get them a handful of points, but it may still put them into a tying or winning position. And I think that's what they're going for with the gambits here. It's not something where you can like completely and totally ignore the first half of the game and then hope to roll a 12 or whatever. You've got to be close and competitive, but yet just out of reach to pull off something risky.
I'm going to say something, and I think maybe it'll be a bit controversial, but I think that this is going to add, it's going to add a lot of flavor to streamed competitive games, because at Las Vegas Open, the biggest complaint that the stream team saw in the chat was that people were talking out their scores. Mm. Right. And I think that this is going to give an option for people to want to keep playing.
Yeah.
Even though if it was this edition, it would look inevitable and there'd be no reason to keep playing. So I'm really excited to see what kind of flavor this is going to bring to top table streamed games.
That is perfectly said. Could not say more. There's been once again, as an analyst, Paul could probably say something similar. There comes a time in a lot of competitive games where turn three is over and you look at the scoreboard, you look at what's left, and you'd be like, yeah, this is absolutely done. There's little to no point playing the last two turns. Just having a deck that you could just rip anything off the top, you know, double aces could come up for you. And all of a sudden you're down by six. Now you're up by one and there's sweats on your opponent. I think there could be nothing more exciting in a game. Go, Red.
So to play on that though, and I do love the references, put it all on red,
double aces, ripping double aces.
That's right.
We'll see how many more can get in.
As a philanthropist and lover of all humankind, I have to keep twisting this screwdriver in right now. When it comes to, you know, people complaining about a game that they lost to, having this initiative seized because they rolled a six.
That was me during the break, everyone. That was.
I have to say, I cannot wait to hear the first human that complains about losing because of a card draw. You know how people are always blaming the dice. I mean, I know. We've never done that.
There None seems to have. Be a combination, though, of like the card choice and a situation and a role. You know what I mean?
It's going to be so good. I'm telling you, though. Because it's going to be like, well, I just drew this card, and then that was it. That was the game. It's like, you're right. You're right. None of the rest of the game. Like, it was that one card. That was it. That's what got you. I hate to say it, but man, if only I said it too in our pre-show time. It's talking about, you know, you're only as good as your last failure. And man, that those cards between the dice and the cards, they're going to get some people. I'll hate it for them. I wish that, that they'll be able to make it through all these hard times ahead, but it's coming. The cards are going to get you, folks.
So there are some things that happen towards the end. It remains to be seen if this is even going to be a necessary thing. But to Red's point, there are things that the game and the community did to mitigate some of these things. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but I remember the last time I played a big tournament that used a Maelstrom deck, I was allowed to take a number of cards out of the deck. Like things that I could not score, things that were extremely hard for me to score. I kind of sculpted. Yeah,
you
deck
didn't
that.
Have any flyers in your list or whatever. You could take
exactly right. You could take those cards out. You'd have no dead draws. Was the idea. The idea was every card was doable, and of course some were extremely hard, but still doable if you went for them, and some were extremely easy. And I think that narrowed a lot of the variance down. Well, at least it eliminated a lot of the feels bad, where you just end up with three cards in your hand, and I'm like, okay, I'm a tower player, and I have to do three charges. This is a bad option. I'm Votan. I have to get behind enemy lines. This also sucks. All my pioneers are dead.
Yeah, that was turn one. Pioneers are gone.
rough day at the office. Those kind of things. You can mitigate some of the big blowout cards.
And then, I mean, let's go with some of the CD underside when you're dealing with this deck element of it is, you know, we've heard of players that may have removed cards or replaced cards in their deck to have more favorable draws. I mean, is that going to be an issue?
Well, the last WTC, World Team Championship, I attended for 8th edition, which is in 2019. We had that mechanic where you had to replace, you could take cards out of your deck, but you had to have them in a pile faced up and show your opponent what you took out, and then they got to count the cards in your deck. They got to count that there was the right amount of cards total, and then they got to cut, shuffle, whatever they want to do to your deck, and then they placed it on your table, and you couldn't touch it. You couldn't shuffle it again unless specifically told to by a card or a mechanic. And so that went a long way, I believe, to mitigating a lot of these things. But there is always that element that
it's not going to happen. People are going to find a way to angle, you know, whatever. But yeah. I'm just pointing out the interesting things.
You're right to bring it up because cards are more fallible than the system we have now for that level.
And I'd like to also bring up, you know, one of the things I've thought about over the course of us discussing this and just kind of, you know, kind of basking in the possibility is like in narrative games or friendly games or casual games or weekend games where your buddy comes over, let's say you completely and totally blow them out in turn one. You're like, you know what, man, I know this, forget the score. You make your gambit, you win. Pizza's on you.
Yeah. I love that stuff. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Tempest of War, is there two packs of cards or are you drawing from the same deck?
It's two.
Yeah, it is two, right? Yeah, I think two. an interesting thing to do would to be have one set of cards and you both draw from the same.
I don't know. I just sort of see it turning into Monopoly where you're like trying to like trade cards with one another. And
if I
mortgage this gambit, I get to
open war was like that.
That's how you kind of
saw that there were asymmetric objectives because there's no way that you're going to end up with the same objective like that.
Yeah, yep. That's what I was thinking of. And I don't mind that system. That system of if you play with, you both bring a deck of cards, you roll up, one of you use just one deck, it doesn't matter which one, they're both the same. I don't think they, like, I get the impression, I'm not sure if this has been stated anywhere, but are there going to be faction cards, like faction secondary cards? Like you buy your Astra Militarum deck and it comes with like a couple of faction secondary cards in there?
Yeah, or is that nothing like that's been discussed or seen or anything?
Okay. That's just a speculation I heard around the cooler tables.
The cool kids it's, tables?
No, the tables under the fan, under the aircon. That's it. I word good.
Look, we're a little rusty. This is the vacation episodes.
I'm the same as I've always been.
So in every game, you and your opponent have both an identical deck of 16 different secondary missions. So by this post on the community page, I would take that to mean that there are not anything like that, at least in the immediate term.
Cool. Never mind. It would be a cool wrinkle to be like certain armies get bonus points for doing certain kinds of objectives. Like you have an Emperor's Champion that kills another character for an assassinate card and it gets one extra point because an Emperor's Champion did the thing rather than it just being some Goomba in your army. That kind of thing would be another nice way to put a wrinkle on it.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe what it says here is you can either play the tactical missions, which is, I think, probably drawing some cards, or fixed missions, which is probably set secondary objectives. So
yeah, how do you think this is going to be adopted for matched play? Are we going to see a TO stand up at the start of the round and then just draw some cards and tell everybody what they're playing? Or do you think they'll draw them ahead of time and put them in the players pack? Or do you think everyone's just going to rock up with their cards and just draw them and play it out as they flop?
That's a great question.
I'm not sure there's a wrong answer.
Yeah, I think it's still going to come down to with the individual TOs. I mean, you know, on this show, we're big believers in the organizers kind of being the masters of their own domain. Mm-hmm.
And people will vote with their feet, you know. If one of these ends up being the better option, we'll know about it pretty soon.
Very true. And you do gotta, you know, you gotta kind of look at the folks in your area, and if they prefer to play a certain way, and you want to cater to them, and you probably should want to cater to them because, you know, the local environment are probably the bulk of what the players would show up.
Yeah,
the community you are servicing.
The 40K community has done quite well at tracking stats for missions, for secondaries, for who's winning going first and second and all these things and all this stuff. Imagine the absolute chaos if everyone just rocks up, pulls their missions off the top of their deck when they get matched into their opponent. It's all out the window, baby. We're starting from scratch.
Well, I going back to the gambits, I kind of like the idea of, you know, I like to play aggressive. I like to use all my pieces, you know, sometimes throw a little caution to the wind.
Really? Yeah, nothing I've previously met or heard about you indicated that, Paul. I'm shocked.
But I like the idea of, you know, maybe, you know, burning hot, you know, the candle at both ends, but, you know, still being able to pull a risky maneuver as long as you've kept it close. And I say risk, probably a high degree of failure, but at least having that be an option instead of playing it to turn three and be like, well, I guess I missed my one point of, retrieve data.
Yeah.
So I guess we might those as well. Darn just cards.
if it wasn't for those kids and those darn cards.
But I think this has been designed with a lot of that data of how players behave and how games have played out in mind. So I don't think it'd be stuff like, you know, do a loop-de-loop with your flyer. Score 1 point.
Just oh, Mario you'd be surprised. Kart. This is a Mario Kart deck.
Oh, peaches.
Throw a blue shell.
Yeah. We have been talking specifically, a lot about match play, but, you know, all these different ways to play are still very supported. And, you know, I like this idea of something to inject a little bit, maybe more fun or risk, cool stories. I mean, everyone has a bad beat story, you know, and everyone has a river rat or sucked out story, and this is going to fuel that type of thing.
We haven't done a show since Warhammerfest, have we?
No, that was right before that, right?
Yeah, Plastic Night Lancers just went.
Yeah, we haven't talked about the preview.
Gimme.
Man, I feel like I missed so much, and yet at the same time.
Have you seen the Plastic Night Lancer, Red?
I did. I was excited to come back and see that. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah, we have not talked about things from Warhammer Fest and the stuff that was previewed for all the stuff. Like, what are some of the other things we saw?
Literally on Warhammer Community right now, scrolling down to it. Damn, yeah, they've been busy.
It's been a bit.
It has been a bit.
Some Horus Heresy characters.
Just the new Nid sculpts. Wow. So impressed. The Screamer Killer. Oh, chef's kiss.
What do y'all think about the Screamer Killer?
Amazing. Such a homage and such an upgrade at the same time.
And then I guess also, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Space Marines.
Really?
I had no idea.
We're learning so much about you this episode, Paul.
Oh my gosh.
I do want to take a moment to talk about the Apothecary Biologus.
Oh, he's pretty cool.
But can you imagine how horrific the interior of that jug he's carrying around is?
Yeah.
So, like, fill me in a little bit on the lore. He's supposed to be basically like a scientist out there, right? Like, he's collecting information about what they're fighting, or what's the deal with him?
I don't know how to put this in a pleasant way. But is he carrying around 40 gallons of gene seed?
Oof, it's a lot. It's a whole jug. We've got a pitcher of gene seed right there.
But he is in Gravis armor, and this is the first apothecary we've seen in Gravis armor. Is that right?
It is. It's true.
Yeah. It's just
Sorry, go red.
Oh no, I was just saying it's awesome.
I'm a big fan of the Terminator Captain.
See, I'm less crazy for the Terminator Captain. It's cool. It's a Terminator Captain. He is cool. He looks fantastic. I'm more excited about the Libby and the Apothecary. See, I think that Apothecary has such a beautiful neutral stance. You just replace the head, the hands, and then just carve off the little apothecary symbol on the shin there. And that guy is pretty much any Gravis character you would want.
Oh, you mean it's like a captain, chaplain, or whatever? Just
oh, yeah. That guy is beautiful, neutral stance, well-posed, all the right bits in the right places. I'm a big fan. I think you could use that guy for just about anything.
Jug of gene juice?
Yeah. it's two words. Actually, it's one word for some reason. Stern guard.
Yes.
Hopefully you guys ever got the joke, but those models are fan-freaking-tastic. Such, once again, beautiful homage to the originals, a wonderful update at the same time. Got the tabards, looks like they come with every gun. Just which gun? Every gun. We've got the combi plaz, we've got the combi melter, we've got the heavy bolter, we've got all the primaris guns you could like. But also, what Mark head was it? Is it the Mark 8 heads? With they're like the Darth Vader heads? To the Mark 8s? Mark 9s?
I'm not a Mark 8 scholar.
Fair enough. Someone will correct me.
Darth Vader, just keep going. I'm trying to catch your description.
They had the mouth grill. Instead of the vents, they had the grill.
That was the 7.
Okay. Yeah, the marks.
I think Mark 8 still had it too. Yes.
Okay. But yeah, big fan. I think they look fantastic. I'm very excited. And also, interesting, they're not called Primaris Stern Guard veterans.
Yeah, they're just called the Stern Guard veterans.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a shape of things to come, where we no longer have just here's the Primaris, here's the non-Primaris. We just have these are the squads now. Over the last couple of years, Space Marine Legions and chapters have become so blended and integrated, there's no distinction anymore.
It says here on the page, they primarily wear Tacticus armor, but it has been adorned with relics and combined with parts from older armor marks to demonstrate their station in the chapter.
Beautiful. I love it. Then we come to Adam's ugly duckling.
Dang.
Are you about to like diss on the Inferno squad?
No. First squad looks great, actually. Except for them all having, you know, needing some really good insurance for those left hands that are going to get charred within like one engagement because they're on top
come
of
on,
the
power flamer. Armor's power armor. Don't forget.
Top of the flamer. Just no, the Ballistus Dread. Not a fan.
Yeah, I think it looks kind of goofy too.
The new Rifleman Dread.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually,
the Rifleman is a specific type of double autocannon dread.
I guess down on the we just. Actually down under, mate. It's just referred to any dread that has two guns. No
okay.
Fists,
all right.
There you go. But you are right.
Win in Rome. Dread
originally started as the double autocannon, a Grey Knight double autocannon dreadnought down here was the original rifleman dread. But only criticism I have of this guy is the top half looks fantastic and the legs look too long. So
yeah, like it looks like he skips leg day.
Yeah, what I'm going to do is I'm going to build up his base. Well, firstly, I'm going to carve off all the joining bits in between his calves and his thighs, and then a little bit off the ball joint between the torso and the thing. And then however much I take that off the overall silhouette, I'm going to build that much up on the base. So if I manage to take a half an inch off the leg profile, I'll put him half an inch off the base. So he's still the same height, but just looks a bit more squat, a little bit more proportionate.
Man, you got it all wrong. You need to have him being held up by two stern guard.
On a palanquin.
Yep.
Do you know what I first thought when I saw it? I have seen some people convert dreads to be on the legs from Onaga Doom Crawlers to putting a redemptor on legs. This guy on those would look amazing.
Very interesting.
We haven't even talked about Nid sculpts.
I'm sorry. Let's jump over to Nid. I did jump us right to the Marines when you brought up Tyranids, and I apologize.
It's fine.
But I need to just talk about I feel like the Infernus squad is going to be red in the future.
Because fire's red, right? Like, no other reason.
It's get up cause... close and personal. You got to think that, you know, you want to be up there close anyway. You might as well.
Well, I'm super excited to put 10 of these guys in a Land Raider Crusader in my Templars. Just 10 good old Flamer boys jumping out of a Land Raider seems amazing.
Yeah. And let's go into the Tyranids. The Screamer Killer does look horrific. Like, that is the stuff. That's nightmare fuel.
If by horrific you mean gorgeous, absolutely correct.
And the paint job.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I love this new take on Leviathan colors, because before it was like very bright white, it felt like, and like kind of a brighter purple. And I really like that it's like more organic looking colors.
I do like the blending of colors. I don't like the hard edge of his where the chitin or the chitin ends and the flesh begins. I liked how it's almost got that bruised purple between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love everything about this new kind of take on the Tyranid Leviathan colors.
It does look bruised, and, you know, like there's working parts on this thing that are getting whatever its ichor inside pumped to it. And maybe like it just tore out of the ground. It's got dried blood all over it. I mean, it looks amazing.
And now it comes to the question on everyone's lips: who was Von Ryan, and how did he get to name the Leapers?
You didn't even. Man, I wasn't even here, and I saw that article.
Perfect. Lay it on me.
No, I mean, like it laid it all out. It was in the. In fact, what's crazy is I think it's actually even a throwback to like third edition, where that's where like the original story was or something.
What, the first guy to get eaten by a Leaper?
Something like it. I mean, you know, the whole Tyranid thing coming from the planet Tyrannus or whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. But yeah, that there's definitely a tie-in from third edition, which I thought was a pretty cool throwback.
I'm going to have to go looking for that. I just imagined a guy being eaten by a Leaper be like, make sure you name them after me.
he was trying to take a selfie or whatever with something he caught. That is... His face ripped off.
Got numbed. Yeah. We've had what's the Neuro Tyrant, which just looks like it's a, what happens if you made a tyrant, a hive tyrant out of a neurothrope? Yeah.
It says it's a support creature, and sure, but I mean, things are vicious.
Are they sure?
Yeah. So the Neuro Tyrant is a support focused creature. I mean, support are looking scary. I'm going to need some support.
Yeah. It looks incredible to me. It looks like the queen out of Aliens when she first walks in and sees the queen sitting there on her little throne with the big old abdomen laying the eggs in the middle of the hive. The top half of the model just evokes that for me entirely.
Yeah, good point there. Neurogaunts going down the list here.
Okay, I just have to say these things creep me out. Only because their face looks like that weird bug that becomes like a parasite in fish and like becomes their tongue. Have you seen those?
Oh no, what is that? Maybe I don't want to know.
Do not Google it. It is nightmare fuel. And these, like, I swear their face is like modeled off that weird parasite. It creeps me out. I love it because I feel like that is what Tyranids should be trying to emulate is like anything that gives you the heebie-jeebies. So like this hits the mark perfectly for me.
Yeah. What I find really interesting about this squad is that it is quite obviously has a sergeant, has one model that's bigger than the others. And if that is the case, it is the first Tyranid kit to ever have a sergeant model in the unit.
You think
which
so?
Which is quite well. I can't say for sure, but there is obviously one bug of these 10 bugs that is bigger than the other bugs. That yeah, usually would note some kind of leadership. Doesn't necessarily mean it could just be the special weapon or like
synapse
something
or
like that.
It says underneath it. It says larger node beasts can be distinguished by the bulbous growth on their backs, while the smaller gaunts chitter around it with sharp claws.
We have established Adam is not reading.
I am not a reader. So this actually doesn't say on this one, the one I'm reading.
Pictures.
Maybe you look at some.
Yeah, that's on the like the actual the Warhammerfest tagged thing where they get the new Tyranid stuff.
There you go. I'm looking in the wrong place. But even if I wasn't, I am, you know, astoundingly not a reader. Audiobooks have ruined me, people. I blame them. Their ease.
It's hard not to get distracted by the cool looking models.
I mean, you picked up what they were throwing down, though.
I did. Yeah. It's intuition.
That's right.
In all the wrong ways. We got barb gaunts. These are weird looking, right?
Oh, you don't skip the new termagants.
Oh, see, we're looking at different documents, obviously. Oh.
It's okay. Yep. Yeah, 20 of them in total in the new Leviathan box coming in the termagants.
Hell yeah. They look good. And they look like they may not constantly fall on their face at every opportunity.
It's very important.
Yep. I like to joke because when I see Hormugans, especially Hormugans that don't constantly fall over, I ask people how much money they have taped to the bottom of their bases.
There's like, $1.90 in termagants.
Just, keeping these boys flat. But the barb gaunts, this is the one where I think the painting scheme has made them, I can't quite tell what they are because they look like they have a gun on their shoulder or another organism on their shoulder that is painted High Fleet Behemoth. And then they are High Fleet Leviathan. I'm not sure.
And does it like shoot straight? Does it launch indirect or whatever? Like what do these things do? We don't know.
Are they a parrot on their shoulder and they leap at the opponent and just like, you know, go straight for the eyes.
Okay, well, do you want me to read the paragraph underneath for them and give you an idea?
Do need supervision at this point, yes.
Okay, I'm going to read it. Barb gaunts are a Tyranid artillery organism working closer to the front line than Hiveguard and Biovores. The biocannons on their backs are actually bonded with the same parasitic organism that has enslaved the rest of the gaunt to its will, merging body and weapon into a single lethal entity.
Damn, okay. That's cool. So wait, there are bioforms in the Hive Fleets that are parasitic to other bioforms of the Hive Fleets. That's a cool little distinction.
I like it.
I like it a lot.
I like the idea of like multiple like medium gun bugs.
Well, it's been a big gap in the range, hasn't it? You either have to have something that has three wounds to get a decent gun on it, or one wound and like a devour is the best you're going to manage. There's really no in between.
I literally just looked up close and it's like they're standing on three legs and then the other hand is like holding it like a bazooka. I just noticed that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll be like a rocket launcher kind of deal.
I'm sold. And the last thing is the psychophage. Another one of these just horrific looking creatures.
Gross. I love it.
Does anyone else just see a flesh and blood venom crawler?
Oh.
Yeah, I do.
It's very Venom Crawler-esque. I mean, I ain't mad at it, but that is very much what I saw the first time.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what the stuff coming out of the stalks. Sorry, Red, go ahead.
No, to Adam's point, I did think, especially the face, there's a lot to that Venom Crawler that kind of resonates there.
The stuff coming out of the stalks, like, is that part of its defense mechanisms? Like, what's it doing?
You know, whenever I see that smoke stuff, I always think Venom Crawler. Sorry, Venom Throat.
It's a massive psychophage. It's an organic furnace that gobbles up enemies and turns their essence into a raging psychoclastic torrent.
See, didn't even need to read it. Just look at the picture, figure it all out.
Man, say that five times fast. Psychoclastic torrent.
I stared at those letters. I was like, please get me through this. Just please.
This thing is giving me the Thing vibes also. I'm also here for this. This is how the bugs are sort of portrayed in the lore. They're always like incomprehensible, and whenever you read about them, like their enemies don't know how they work. They don't know what they do until it's too late and they can actually see what they do. And so this whole looking at it, we can speculate what it might do. But in the end, it's just like an eldritch horror, really. And I love it.
It's neat that the names of these creatures seem to be reflective. I mean, and it's very apparent in like Von Rhein's leapers or whatever they are in the Screamer Killer, is that whatever they ate first, those are the people that named them. Or whoever's hiding behind a bush, you know, when that was happening. That is. And so we don't even really know what these things are. It speaks to the unnameable horrors that they actually are. This is our impression of what they're doing and what we've documented, you know, to try to protect ourselves. That's kind of cool.
I'd really like J-Dub to kind of take the Mickey out of themselves a little bit with this naming convention, like the next biggest, like Lord of War, Norn Queen-esque release. It should just be called David's Queen. David's Gribbly. At least like release it on April 1st, and then like next week come out with the actual, you know, Norn Queen, whatever it's called. Yeah,
they have 11 more months of planning on that one.
Yeah, chop chop, dude.
It's gonna work. Workshop it. That's it.
Could be Matthew. Could be Greg. Could be Sarah. You know, Danielle.
Look, I can't think of a better way to end this show. So you know,
it's not going anywhere better than this. This is it.
Look, we're still kicking back. We're on a beach somewhere. I wish we were on a beach somewhere.
One last shout out to the Get Off the Road diorama from Lord of the Rings release.
Very nice.
It's actually my favorite scene in the entire trilogy, because I've never found something as kind of macabre as these beautiful, like, Hobbiton roads, fields and mushrooms and things, and then this absolutely not meant to be there wraith just flying along at like galloping speed. It's beautiful.
It's a very tense scene. No, that's not the last shout out. I have to give a shout out to the Warhammer Meta Chasers.
Oh, who might those handsome gentlemen be?
A collection of folks that like to talk about the big tournaments coming up over the weekend. They have a YouTube channel called the Warhammer Meta Chasers. You can check it out. They do a live show every Thursday starting at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Mm-hmm. We are on that. Adam, you and I, Adam, are on that.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
With Dustin Henshaw, we talk about some of the biggest tournaments coming up over the course of the weekend. We do the live show. We have a great chat community. It is awesome. It's on its own YouTube channel. You can actually subscribe to that and a channel in iTunes called Warhammer Life, and that will get you access to FTN show if you haven't already subscribed, and also the Warhammer Meta Chasers. So I definitely suggest you do that if like learning about the meta and talking about tournaments, or just like hanging out and having a good time, because it is an interactive show with the live chat and everything else. And so it's got a good energy and vibe to it. I wanted to direct you to that since it is a brand new channel on YouTube, and you can also find it wherever you get your podcast. And that's our show this week.
It's a good time.
Nailed it.
We're going to get back to the normal routine of things, whatever that routine ends up being, very soon. If this is your first time checking us out, we hope you enjoyed it. You see, we're big fans of Warhammer and looking forward to where things are going. Please do not forget to like, share, and subscribe. Leave some comments if you see this. Please consider, you know, checking out the t-shirts, checking out the Patreon. It's one way of many to interact with the show. Talk to us on Twitter and on Instagram and that kind of stuff. It's been a blast. We will see y'all real soon. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.
Horseback scan is clear. I think they're gone. For now.